This episode is made possible by Awin. Unlock unlimited marketing opportunities that reach consumers everywhere using Awin's affiliate partnerships platform. Choose which partners best match your marketing objectives, control your costs by defining how you pay, and customize your affiliate marketing program using Awin's tech to mirror your unique goals, whatever they may be. Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more and get started today. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. This is the Friday show that has a solitary, minuscule plant in the background. Right, Max?
It's thriving, thank you. It's brand new and it's thriving.
It'll be dead by the end of the show. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, is Threads already finished?
The teens and Zoomers or Gen Zers on Instagram saw a push, heard about it, thought, I'll give this a try. And looking at the engagement numbers that have followed, a lot of them said, not for me.
The impact of streamflation.
So even if you're bundling all these streaming services on your own, you know, stacking up against the cable bill still looks pretty good from my perspective.
Will TikTok be the most significant social app in 2 years?
Barring some miraculous product invention on Meta's part and a pretty serious reversal of sentiment among younger consumers, I can't imagine that TikTok won't still be on top.
Is the generative AI boom already over? And I've got some interesting facts about Americans and their road trips. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our director of reports editing based out of upstate New York. It's Rahul Chadha, ladies and gentlemen. He's back.
Hey, Marcus. Nice to be back.
There he is. Great to have you, mate. We're also joined by one of our senior analysts on the digital advertising and media team based in Virginia. It's Evelyn Mitchell-Wolf.
Hello, folks.
Hello, hello. And finally, we have another senior analyst on that very team based out of Philadelphia. It's Max Willens.
Yo.
Hey, fella. So, what do we have in store for you today? Well, we'll start by talking about whether Threads, Meta's Twitter X alternative, is already finished. Then we move to the debate of the week this week, where our panel will try to present the best for and against arguments they can from each of the three stories we have for you. And then finally, we end with dinner party data. We talk about some random trivia. But we start, of course, with the story of the week. Is Threads already finished? Well, traffic on Meta's Threads is declining, writes Naomi Nix of the Washington Post. She notes that although Mark Zuckerberg's Twitter alternative Threads has attracted over 100 million signups less than a week after it was unveiled, it has struggled to maintain its early momentum, according to third-party analytics firms. Worldwide daily active Android users on Threads peaked on July 7th. Matter of days after it came out, at 50 million, half of Twitter or X's number, notes SimilarWeb, before plummeting. So it hit 50 million and then plummeted to 10 million a month later on, just 4 weeks after it came out. Average time spent in the app also tanked, falling from 21 minutes, which is a few minutes off Twitter's average, to just 3. Our very own senior director of briefings, Jeremy Goldman, writes that it's far too soon to consider Threads the next Google Plus, Vine, or Yik Yak. Threads has the potential to find its own niche as a platform, assuming Meta gives it the time. End of his quote. But folks, do we agree? Or is Threads already finished?
I made a big deal of this. I think the first time we talked about Threads on this show.
You pronounced it dead on arrival almost.
I did do that, yes. And I am sticking with it.
You might be right.
I think part of the reason, or my reasons essentially, are unchanged, which is just to say that Twitter has a kind of reason for existing for all of its problems, and there are lots of them. It is still a great place to go when you want to kind of stick a fire hose of information into your face. You can connect with lots of journalists, with world leaders. It is still where, you know, important conversations happen on major news and events. And at the moment, it seems like there is no real reason for Threads to exist other than maybe catching people who have said, the hell with Twitter, I want to go somewhere else. And I think one of the things that bears that out actually is some of the data around who is using it. So Sensor Tower put out some research at the beginning of this month, I think, which showed that nearly two-thirds of Threads' user base is between the ages of 18 and 24. And that's way, way, way younger than the user base that you see on Twitter, according to our own forecast. About 20% of its user base in the US is that age. And that, to me, just screams that, you know, Threads is a novelty. The teens and Zoomers or Gen Zers on Instagram, you know, saw a push, heard about it, thought, eh, I'll give this a try. And looking at the engagement numbers that have followed, a lot of them said, eh, not for me, and moved on. And I think that that's what's happened.
Yeah, young folks aren't sold. So according to our new Gen Z social media survey, two-thirds of these young people didn't use Threads as of July 25th, and even less of the 15 to 17-year-olds had used the platform as well. So yeah, if you're looking at young people being an indicator for future trends, it doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, I think Threads got big fast because, like you mentioned, Max, it was super easy to sign up, not because it was anything special. And what I don't fully understand is why Meta launched Threads when it did, because my understanding is, like you mentioned, Max, also, that Meta saw an opportunity in Twitter's decline. It was still Twitter, right, when Threads was launched? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So Twitter, now X, has dug itself into a very deep hole. It left all its other tools at the surface. It's very unlikely that it'll be able to change trajectories. So I don't think Meta had to kind of take that minimum viable product in Threads to market yet. It could have waited and developed more features. And I think it still would have seen, no matter when it launched, it would have seen that kind of remarkable initial traction if it had kept it so easy to sign up. So, you know, you only get launch hype once. It seems like they've squandered it on Threads so far.
Do we think that the ship has sailed then in terms of, you said, that kind of launch hype? Because it does seem as though Meta jumped the gun with Threads. They forced Threads out of the door when Elon Musk decided to cap the number of tweets users could view each day on Twitter, which upset some Twitter folks. And they pushed the product out, was missing some key features, didn't have a chronological feed, DMing wasn't possible, hashtags, and they were hoping that folks would hang around long enough for future updates. But is that possible anymore, or is kind of the window closing on that opportunity?
I think that there's plenty of other social platforms for people to check. You know, it's not like, if, you know, people are going to say, man, I think I'm just going to give this 6 more months. Maybe it'll get better.
Let it bake some more.
Yeah, they're just going to double tap, you know, flick that closed and find something else to look at, you know, when they're on the toilet or, you know,
wherever they are. It's not NBA Game Pass, right, Max?
That's exactly
right.
You'll
give that some time to get better for sure. But something like this, there's just too many alternatives.
Look, I have a debilitating addiction and I have to manage it as best as I can.
Let's talk it out. But so one thing on that, so wondering whether future updates could lead to a spike in usage. Threads recently said that users could share a post on Threads in a DM on Instagram, which they say coincided with a gain in daily users, according to Sensor Tower. However, Threads daily active users, they're still down 75% from launch. So a change or an additional feature added and a small bump in usage isn't going to bring it back to the numbers that it saw when it first launched. Rahul, I'm wondering whether, so Miss Nix of the Washington Post was noting that Threads' main rival, Twitter/X, has been stagnating as well, according to data from SimilarWeb. Is this a bit of a referendum on text-based social networks? The fact that, you know, people wanted an alternative to Twitter to some extent, and some of them moved over to Threads, and now they're unhappy with that experience. But Twitter isn't, like, it's not like they ran back to Twitter is necessarily flourishing. Do you think that some of those folks are just swapping out that text-based social media behavior for more visual-based social media, video-based social media like TikTok, YouTube?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, one of the things I always think about when we talk about Twitter is just comparatively how low its user numbers are. But like, as Max mentioned, it has a very dedicated cohort of users. You know, when I think about Twitter versus Threads, you know, I think Meta just has the pockets to keep adding additional features if you can get to feature parity with Twitter. There is no real downside, I think, from their perspective in playing the long game and just trying to slowly add users via, you know, trying to reach feature parity with Twitter. I think the other big question in my mind is always like, what's Elon Musk going to do next? Like, there's always the potential he's just going to do something to scare away a bunch more users. And if at some point in the future, Threads' feature set looks a lot more like Twitter's today, I don't think it's impossible that people might flee Twitter. Will they all go to Threads? I don't know. Maybe some of them might, you know, go and move to another platform like Mastodon. But, you know, in terms of the future, that's a good question. I don't have the answer really, which is the future of text based social media. I mean, you know, it made me think of the fact that TikTok recently added like text only features, text only posts, but you know, they're not really trying to create anything similar, I think, to what Twitter as it exists today. They're just kind of, you know, creating an add-on for people, I think, who are more like in the content creator mindset. Mm-hmm.
I think that the question of whether text-based posting is, you know, on the decline is really interesting, actually. And I do think that if you look at sort of the behavior that's encouraged by something like a TikTok versus the behavior that was invited by, you know, Twitter in the early years, it is really quite different. Like with TikTok, you can basically just kind of sink into your chair and just swipe and swipe and swipe and swipe. You don't have to really engage with anything at all if you don't want to. Whereas with Twitter, part of the fun of it was the sort of immediacy of being able to interact with people and get into conversations at the drop of a hat. And it's entirely possible that, you know, if you're a teenager or someone in their early 20s who kind of came up mostly looking at social as something that they experienced via Instagram and TikTok, you might not get the appeal of, you know, getting into it with strangers via short messages. So I think that that's a really interesting thing to sort of pay attention to over the longer period.
Yeah. Well, Threads, they said they're launching a desktop version. So we'll see if that helps with engagement at all. That's what we've got time for the story of the week, though. It's time now for the debate of the week. Today's segment, Make the Case. Our panel, Max, Evelyn, and Rahul, present the for and against arguments for each of the following questions based on three news stories. Two contestants face off per question. Also, the following takes don't necessarily reflect the analysts' personal views. Their job is to just present the best case regardless and offer objective analysis. So, for question one, it's Rahul going up against Evelyn. We're talking about the impact of streamflation. Streamflation is here, and media companies are betting you'll pay up, notes a recent Wall Street Journal piece. It points out that the average cost of watching a major ad-free streaming service is going up by nearly 25% in about a year, as entertainment giants bet that customers will either pay up or switch to their cheaper, more lucrative ad-supported plans. The article cites Lightshed Partners analyst Rich Greenfield, who says, "Can you raise prices by 30% and not increase churn? That's the big question." And so our question is, yeah, can you? Streamflation is here, but will folks just pay the increased price? Rahul, you're going to present the will case, so people will just pay the increased prices. 60 seconds on the clock. Make the case.
Sure. So I did a little bit of math. So if you combine the cost of HBO Max, Hulu, Disney Plus, ESPN Plus, Netflix, and Amazon Prime, you're coming to a total of $65. And that doesn't discount buying an annual subscription. Some services offer that. That compares to the average US monthly cable bill. Sorry, the ranges that I found were all over the map. So at the low end, they were $80. Mm-hmm. So we're still like $15 under that. And it's $220 at the high end. So even if you're bundling all of these streaming services on your own, you know, stacking up against the cable bill still looks pretty good from my perspective. And as far as those who are thinking about downgrading to an ad tier, you know, they're in for a worse user experience. There's no consistency about ad loads among all these services. Streamers still have a huge problem with frequency capping, meaning people see the same ads over and over again. And streamers aren't subject to the same federal regulations about volume levels like broadcast TV is, meaning that when viewers using streaming services see ads, they might be blowing out your eardrums.
Mm. Evelyn, people won't just pay the increased prices. Make the case.
People aren't endless money machines. You know, they have maximum budgets, and we all know wages don't keep up with inflation. And the fact of the matter is, people can't afford to just pay ever-increasing prices for their streaming services, because while it might be $65 now, Rahul, what's to stop it from reaching that 80 and above that would bring it in parity with cable? I think it's far more likely that we'll start to see folks downgrading to those ad-supported tiers worse user experience or not, or kind of we'll see some rhythmic churn going on where consumers will have maybe one or two streaming services that they keep all the time. And then when one of the other streaming services comes out with a must-watch series, we'll see a temporary spike in subscribers for that service. And I think those spikes will be far fewer and far between because the services are all also cutting production costs too. So none of them will be able to support a steady stream of high-budget hits, which just makes consumers even less likely to swallow the price increases.
So the state of play, streaming services and their costs. So today, US households pay $30 a month for an average of four streaming services, according to that journal article. In 2018, they were paying half as much, $15, for half the number of services, two. That's according to S&P Global Market Intelligence. Disney did say that when they increased the ad-free price from $8 to $11, 94% of subscribers ate the $3 increase and stuck with the service. That was going from 8 to 11. You start getting into the double digits and up, then you could see a higher number of people leave, arguably. The thing is, these streaming platforms don't really have a choice but to raise prices. Disney Plus is losing money. Peacock is losing money. Paramount Plus is losing money. Max is losing money. And Netflix is the only one that's not. And so they've kind of painted themselves into a corner, so to speak, because they need to increase prices to be able to make these businesses sustainable, let alone wildly profitable. All right, folks. Question two. And we've got Evelyn going up against Max. Will TikTok be the most significant social app in 2 years? TikTok will be the number one social app in terms of total minutes by 2025, overtaking Facebook. TikTok already overtook Instagram in total minutes last year, and it has Facebook in its sights, and we estimate it will overtake them in total minutes in just 2 years. But does that make TikTok the most significant social app just because it has the most minutes, the most total minutes, at least by 2025? Evelyn, by 2025, TikTok will be the most significant social app. 60 seconds, make the case.
I'll do you one better, Marcus. I'm arguing that TikTok is already the most significant social app.
Do that.
Its cultural cachet is simply unbeatable. You know, TikTok is where trends are set by consumers, of course, but also by the platform itself. It has totally reshaped the social advertising landscape around short video in only a few years. And try as it might, Meta can't get rid of the TikTok watermark on Reels. You know, TikTok is the juggernaut. It has already amassed more time spent than Instagram despite its smaller user base. And as far as 2025, barring some miraculous product invention on Meta's part and a pretty serious reversal of sentiment among younger consumers, I can't imagine that TikTok won't still be on top.
Max, by 2025, or now, as Evelyn suggested, TikTok won't be the most significant social app. Make the case.
Well, Evelyn's made a great case, but if I have to argue this point because she got to the will position before I did in the email, I think the best way to think about this is that it's going to be Facebook in 2025. And the reason is not so much because of the feed, but because of features like marketplace and groups. When you get older and you start a family or you become entrenched in a community, you find yourself being pulled really quite against your will into Facebook groups to keep abreast of what's going on either with your child's school or with, you know, alumni groups. And if you find yourself being dragged rather inexorably into marketplace, if you want to buy yourself some cheap pots for plants that you didn't think you needed. And at the moment, TikTok doesn't have any of those kind of lock-ins, which kind of guarantee Facebook's longevity and have kind of done a lot to ensure Facebook's stickiness well past its point of peak cultural relevance. So I think that unless TikTok can reinvent itself as a groups hub, a used goods marketplace, and a messaging super center, it's going to be Facebook. Sorry to tell you.
Max, you would be a horrible defense lawyer because, like, Evelyn made great points. My client probably did it, but since I promised to represent him, here's a couple of things.
This guy's not paying me enough, Your Honor.
I thought they were excellent points. And I recently got invited to my, high school reunion on Instagram. So can't argue with that. I spent a lot of time on Instagram, so it's not like it needed to pull me back in. But that, to your point, it is, it's all happening there. And I don't even know how it could happen on TikTok. So
yeah. TikTok, yeah, already ahead by daily minutes. Today, TikTok users spend nearly twice as long on TikTok as Facebook users spend on Facebook each day. 31 minutes a day for Facebook people and TikTok's at 54. All right, let's move to our final question here. Question three, and it's Rahul against Max. Is the AI boom already over? Questions Sarah Morrison of Vox, noting that generative AI tools are generating less interest than just a few months ago. When ChatGPT became public at the end of last year, 100 million folks rushed to check it out in less than 2 months. Then, as if by magic, every big tech company announced that they had their own generative AI initiatives in the works. A much smarter GPT-4 hit the market a few months later, which was the next version of ChatGPT. And it had appeared as though by Thanksgiving, robots would be doing all of our work for us. But things, headlines, appear to have calmed down a lot since. The question being, is the AI, generative AI boom already over? So Rahul, the AI boom is already over. Make the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in the trough of disillusionment phase of the Gartner hype cycle. You know, like you mentioned, ChatGPT 3.5's release generated a huge amount of interest, and then everybody and their brother was slapping an AI solution in whatever they were trying to sell to people or show to people. But I think most people are attracted to the novelty, and when they try to use these tools to introduce efficiencies to their lives or their jobs, they hit a wall. I mean, I know I did. We tried to use ChatGPT 3.5 here, and you know, the barrier to getting it to generate a useful outcome is pretty high. I think people are just either fatigued or overwhelmed by it. And prompt engineering, which, can we just take a second to acknowledge how silly that phrase is? Like, I think it's analogous to describing yourself as a query engineer if you ever used Alta Vista. But anyway, even prompt engineering itself is a skill that requires a substantial time investment and sometimes little return on that investment. I think when you add that to the potential regulations that will slow the development of AI, and I think we're going to see a slow burn in Gen AI adoption from here on out, not a boom.
All right, Max, the AI boom isn't already over. Make the case.
So I'm going to step on a little bit of the stuff that I am preparing for a webinar that I'm presenting on generative AI in the workplace. But I would just say that the boom is not over, and it's because of the interest among employers. I think that obviously the thing that sort of catapulted generative AI into our minds was consumer uses, but fundamentally, generative AI is going to be a workplace technology, not a consumer technology. By 2025, our own forecasts show that I think close to a quarter or a third of people in the workplace in the US are going to use generative AI in some form or fashion. What Rahul said about its current limitations is absolutely correct, but I think that the difficulties that we've had internally are not representative of the, you know, pretty plug and play uses that it has, you know, for any company that has to deal with customer service, for companies that have to generate truckloads of marketing copy or do content marketing at scale. And so I think also too, the other piece to remember is that the amount of venture capital that's poured into generative AI has already crossed into the billions. And as those companies try desperately to gobble up market share, we're going to see a sort of secondary wave of hype around the potential of this technology. So not dead at all, just in the office, not at home.
Good
Sorry in advance
folks.
To all of you, because that's what's happening.
Great. Evelyn, what do you think about this?
I think we certainly are in kind of a lull, but I'm on Max's side here. I think it's, I guess you kind of both made the point coming from different directions. We are on our way to a future where generative AI will play a larger role, whether it's, we call it a boom or a slow burn. Either way, the future is coming. And so I just hope that, I mean, my mind is also on kind of the future of the open web and what generative AI will mean for how we interface with the internet, because I do a lot of my job is reading online, and I really hope that my source material doesn't dry up because it's taken over by chatbots who offer no insight whatsoever. So,
yeah. All right, folks. Great arguments, great points. So we've got time for the debate of the week, talking streamflation, whether TikTok's the most significant app and the AI boom already being over. It's time to move on to our final segment of the day. It's dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Let's start with Rahul, because it's his first episode back in a while. Sure. What you got for us, mate?
So I found some interesting data from a company named Flamingo, which I think sells some kind of software to help companies manage the sick time of their employees. So the day of the year that workers most commonly called out sick on was August 24th. Why? I have no idea. That didn't seem like Flamingo did either. Maybe because people like to play hooky in the dog days of summer. I don't know. But the next three dates were all in the colder months of February, October, and December, which I guess made more sense to me if people are getting more likely to be sick then. The most common reason for taking a sick day was cited as a stomach ailment at 54%. Which makes sense because nobody asks follow-up questions when you say you got a GI problem. Nobody wants details about that. That was followed by COVID at 25%. And then interestingly to me, stress and anxiety at 9%, because I feel like people are more apt to take a mental health day these days than they were probably in previous times. And there's a huge, this is different data. I think this came from YouGov, but there's a huge generational gap in thinking about sick days. So according to this YouGov survey from 2022, 60% of 18 to 20-year-olds thought workers were entitled to take all their sick days, regardless of whether they were ill. That figure dropped to about 50% for the 30 to 64-year-old cohort, and then just 36% for those 65 or older. So retirees think, you know, you should really be sick even when you call in sick, I guess, because they don't have jobs anymore.
Wait, so they're saying you should just, like, walk it off?
Walk it off, yeah, I guess so.
Right.
Tough it out.
No, they're just not necessarily considering sick leave as like part of your compensation.
Yeah, it's like not maybe, like your time off, guaranteed time off, I guess.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
But also rub some dirt in it.
I'm wondering if August 24th has anything to do with school starting and maybe parents are like, I gotta recover from this.
That's a good point.
It's Kobe Bryant Day. It's a big deal in the Philippines. Oh. Maybe that's a big part of it. It's absolutely not a big part of it. I know that that's true about August 24th.
All right, Evelyn, you're up.
Okay, I have some more YouGov data. YouGov surveyed just under 9,000 U.S. adults and asked them, if someone you know messages you something funny, which of the following would your response be most likely to include? And I'm just going to go straight into the percentages of these, and you can have a live reaction to what the options are. So first, this is not in first place, this is just in the order of they are on the survey. Haha at 12% of respondents. LOL in all caps at 33%.
Aggressive.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yes, too much.
Too much.
I can't believe y'all said the exact same thing.
Right.
That's funny. Right. At 9%.
Rude.
An emoji of a laughing face at 32%. So that's pretty much tied with LOL, all caps. And then we have something else and not sure. It's not specified anywhere on the page that I could find, but the numbers add up to about 100%. So I'm assuming respondents could only select one option. And I also noticed that react to the message with a haha react was not included as a response option, which is something that I do frequently. So, and I feel like that
penalizing is penalizing the iPhone. So.
Well, I guess in the US, iPhones are more popular, right? But worldwide, Android Narrowly. Is far more popular. So the first thing I did, though, after reading this data was to break things out by age, because I was like, there's got to be something interesting going on there. But I was surprised by how few stark differences there were between age cohorts. Haha is slightly more popular among the 30 to 44 cohort, and LOL, all caps, is less popular among 65 plus. But I think the reality is that the meaning behind these responses is so nuanced and layered that the most accurate answer would be it depends, as is often the case. You know, it depends on the person that sent the text, and it depends on the humor, the type of humor of the message. It depends on the recipient's mood. I mean, I personally very rarely use LOL all caps, but I use LOL lowercase all the time. So
I was wondering if they didn't include the skull emoji as a potential response. It's like, sorry, I just think about it as like as an old, I was like, there was a point where I was like, I'm too old to use LOL. And then I just adopted it. And then I learned about the skull emoji, and I'm like, I feel like I'm too old to use that. Like, it's just the nuance for me is trying to navigate the waters of just, you know, acting my age in online message responses.
So the that's funny comment in a text is one thing, but when people do it in person, it kills me. Because you'll say something and they'll go, yeah, that's funny. And it's like, is it? It's not funny enough for you to actually laugh, but for you to say it is fine. It drives me crazy. It's so weird.
It signals that I have not made you laugh. And that
You and don't I say are anything.
See, again, it's nuance here. There's so much nuance. It's really hard to design a survey question that gets at the heart of this.
I want to know what the like broader package of questions was like, because it's, I mean, it's super interesting, but like, what is the, are they just trying to get at how unable we are to relate to each other anymore? Like, were there questions about concert behavior? Have you guys heard about the
throwing the stuff on
epidemic?
The stage?
Throwing stuff on the stage, streaming, TikToking, like the whole way through it. If you really want to like, you know, fill yourself with fear, look up the threads on Phoebe Bridgers Reddit about concert behavior, how we've all lost the
just
ability
people,
to...
Yeah, forgetting how to behave in public.
Yeah, I feel like the big debate when I used to go to arena shows was like, should you stand up or sit down at your seat? It's like, everybody just sit down. It's like, we don't want to be sitting and watching the show. Why is everybody standing?
Yeah. I gotta stand up. The people...
Oh, you're that guy. Max is that guy.
And I'm already the guy, like, yeah, it's people already get mad at me if they get behind
me
at a concert.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That
I
is
know.
True.
You're it's, the worst. Max, you're up.
So I don't know how long this has been true or if I only just recently noticed it, but I listened to an episode of this show recently, Marcus, where you said that, you know, just interesting factoids will do. We don't need to have percentages and such. And so I'm really going to lean into that this week. We've been talking a lot about streaming, a lot about streaming sustainability, about whether streaming is going to survive, or not survive, but like whether all the services that are floating around are going to survive. And it got me thinking a lot about how a lot of the services that I really like the most, I don't necessarily watch them all the time, but just like them the most because they exist, are streaming services that are filled with like, you know, random foreign stuff that is sort of hard to find anywhere else and sort of worrying that these things are going to go away. So I'm going to use my dinner party data segment to Kate for Topic, Mubi, and Canopy. Do you guys use any of these?
I used to use Canopy when my library system supported it.
I know, that's the big problem. So I'll quickly run through these. So Canopy, as Rahul mentioned, is a streaming service that was launched in Australia about 12 years ago. And the idea is rather than paying every month, your membership is essentially funded by your participation in a library system. So if all you have to do is enter your library card and it gives you access to a pretty awesome collection of old movies, British television, and actually a lot of really good Chinese cinema. If you want to watch a movie that will just make you want to like, you know, walk into the ocean with bricks in your pockets, you should watch An Elephant Standing Still, which is completely incredible, but it is so, so, so depressing. Then there's Mubi, which was started by a Turkish guy who was trying to watch the movie In the Mood for Love and couldn't find a place to stream it online. They said, this is BS. I want to fix this. And so he launched this service that specializes in foreign films, but they own a production studio. They own a distribution outlet and a third piece as well, which sort of makes them very vertically integrated. And the third one is Topic, which is owned by Pierre Omidyar, the eBay founder who has been trying to sort of build a media empire with First Look Media and mostly failing at it. But Topic is great. It has Parlement, which I think is like the funniest show no one ever talks about, and this Canadian show that I'm really enjoying right now called Happily Married, which is about two couples who send their kids away to summer camp and then are instantly plunged into lives of crime and murder.
Ooh.
And it's a comedy. So
nice.
Win.
So Max, I said you didn't need to bring numbers. I didn't say you could just plug random niche streaming platforms.
I got a number. The number is 3. There are 3 streaming services that I think are really
well
cool.
Played.
Not enough people.
I tried
really hard to find their subscriber numbers, which, you know, maybe is a bad sign for all 3 of these things I could not find. So
yeah, I would plug Canopy because if you're a fan of the documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman, I think that's the only streaming platform that his films are available on, or at least this was true like maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And Mubi, I forgot about, but I used to use that because it's the one where their model is kind of like you have a 30-day window to watch the film, right? I don't know if it's still like that.
I should know the answer to this. I think there are some movies that's true on, but they also just have like a permanent library of stuff as well.
Mm. Very nice. Give me some of the smaller folks some recognition. I appreciate that. So I got one for you real quick. It's about road trips. 5 facts for you. So I'm about to go on a road trip, which is why this is top of mind. So number one, how many people are going on road trips each summer? More than 200 million Americans will take a road trip during any given summer. That's nearly 2/3 of Americans. It doesn't have to be...
Love a good road trip.
Yes. Doesn't have to be like to the end of the earth. It could just be a couple of hours. Number two, what share of American vacations are by car? Well, pre-pandemic 2019, there were some numbers. 85% of summer travel in the US was done by car. 8% was by rail, cruise, or other. 7% of people flew.
Cruise? Where are they cruising to domestically? There's just so much land. Oh, okay. Sure.
Where are they cruising to?
Well, you
could
start.
I guess you could go down the... There's so much in the middle of the country that you can't get to by cruise. This was my kind of fascination.
That's true. I don't know how much of that is cruise. Maybe it's mainly rail, which also is quite surprising. No, it's a beautiful country. Lots to see. The train should be better. But I am a little bit surprised given the current condition. But yeah, just 7% of people flew versus 85% of people who drive somewhere. Number three, how far are they traveling? The average road trip takes a little under 3 hours. So not too far. However, 18% of summer road trips will journey 500 miles or more. That'll get you about a sixth of the way across the country. Number four, why do Americans take road trips? Number one reason is the simple fact that driving is a lot cheaper than flying. According to 53% of folks in a survey from one poll in Quaker State from 2022, the second reason for driving versus flying was seeing and experiencing more together. And then third was spending quality family time with one another. Wonder how long that lasts.
Yeah, I was about to say. Aw, but okay.
Number five, final one here, is the most popular road trip. Anyone know where the most popular road trip is in the country?
Disney World.
Vegas?
No.
Grand Canyon?
Nope.
Yellowstone?
No, the Blue Ridge Parkway.
Oh, hey, I live there.
Yeah, North Carolina and Virginia, America's most popular road trip according to AAA. Grand Pacific Northwest.
It's so pretty, y'all. The Blue Ridge Parkway, highly recommend. Really gorgeous, yeah.
Grand Pacific Northwest, 550 miles through Oregon and Washington State is second, and then the Smoky Mountains, 500-mile loop with views of America's most visited national park. Smoky Mountains, America's most visited national park, but third most popular road trip in the U.S.
Does anyone else feel like road trips have gotten substantially shorter as they get older? I feel like
that's what I
feel
was
like
thinking.
When I was... Yeah, like when I was little, yeah, it seemed like an age with 3 hours on a trip.
I guess it just goes to how you do want to define a road trip. But to me, a road trip, I don't know, it's like invokes the cliche of the journey is the destination, kind of like being on the road was the point. You were going to some place that was like kind of obscenely far away with your friends and it was going to take like 20 hours of driving.
Something.
3 hours, that's like, I don't know, that's like a daily jaunt or something. Like,
commute. I
feel like it has the heft of a road trip.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting fact about driving. So distracted driving, leading cause of accidents on road trips, mainly it's smartphones' fault, unsurprisingly. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, taking your eyes off the road for 5 seconds if you're driving at 55 miles per hour is like driving the length of an American football field with your eyes closed.
That's comforting.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I bet that takes down the number of people who want to go on road trips. Anyway, that's all we've got time for today's episode. We'll leave you on that cheery note. You can always come to us for optimism. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Rahul, ladies and gentlemen. He's back.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you to Max.
Always a pleasure, Marcus.
And thank you to Evelyn.
Thank you, Marcus. Thanks, everyone.
And thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys hopefully on Monday. For the Behind the Numbers, no, we won't. It's Labor Day. We'll see you guys hopefully on the day after, Tuesday, for the Behind the Numbers Daily eMarketer podcast, still made possible by Awin. Happy weekends.